You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast. This is Whitney Neggebauer, the director of Whale Scout. And I'm very excited today because we have a huge guest on our show, Ari Friedlander from the new show, Continent 7, Antarctica, from National Geographic. And I've spent the last few days catching up on the show and watching all these different scientists travel to Antarctica and do amazing research on this continent. And I cannot wait to talk with Ari Friedlander later in the show today and talk about his research on minke and humpback whales down there. But first, I have a few reminders that I want to send out. Right now, we are having our end of the year fundraiser, and it is hosted on the Indiegogo platform. And we have amazing perks for your donations. One that we're featuring today, which I cannot believe we still have, is Robin Baird's new book, The Lives of Hawaii's Dolphins and Whales, Natural History and Conservation. This book, I emailed Robin like a month ago to see if I could get a copy of this book and have him sign it and donate it for the fundraiser. And I had it in my cart on Amazon, and I was super pumped to get this book. And then I went to an American Cetacean Society meeting where he was speaking and then signing books, and it was sitting there on the table, and it's huge, and it's like every photo is beautiful and glossy. And I cannot say how much I love this book. And so it is up on our Indiegogo fundraiser right now, signed by Robin Baird for just $60 for your donation. There are a ton of other perks up there, and we have our video talking about what we hope to accomplish in 2017. A lot of what we're raising money for this year is to help support our volunteers. Volunteering is really at the heart of what we do, whether it's land-based whale watching or going out and restoring salmon habitat. And our volunteers are really like the spokespeople for the whales. And they go out and they do a lot of really hard work in less than awesome weather. And so we want to just help invest in them, in their education, in equipment and supplies. And they are just, again, like I said, at the heart of what we do, and your donation goes to helping these volunteers do the awesome work that they're doing to save our Puget Sound endangered killer whales. Another thing you can do to help our endangered whales is to submit your comments on the Snake River salmon issue. Comments are due on January 17th, and so you can just go online, Google Snake River Dams salmon comments, and there's lots of information that you can read about and learn about, and then you can go ahead and submit your comments and make sure that your voice and the whales' voices are heard. And now I'd like to welcome Ari Friedlander onto the Whale Scout Podcast. He is featured on the new hit show from National Geographic called Continent 7 Antarctica. Ari, how's it going?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved studying whales in Antarctica? I mean, there's whales all over the world. Why Antarctica with all of the challenges that the continent throws at you?
Yeah, you know, I can't say that I went after it in any way. When I first got the opportunity to go to the Antarctic, I was working on whales in North Carolina, and I was given an opportunity to go down as part of an Australian Antarctic expedition. And from the, you know, the first day I got down there, I felt something very different about the place, and it just it kind of grabbed a hold of me. And ever since being down there, I've thought of ways and sort of figured out ways to get our research going down there, and it's become a very important place to me personally as well as for my research.
What makes it so special to you?
You know, to me, I think it's one of those places in the world that is absolutely wild. It's absolutely unique. It doesn't have the feel of human presence, although that the specter of things like climate changing and commercial whaling are very present there. But it's an environment and an area that people really don't have the capacity to survive in. And so I feel like it's an environment that behaves on its own outside of human influence in a lot of ways.
And the TV show Continent 7 Antarctica, it shows a lot of other scientists going out and studying volcanoes, and they have with them a survival expert. And I didn't notice that with your team. I mean, how have you learned to stay safe in Antarctica?
Well, you know, we do similar kinds of research on whales in all different parts of the world. And the thing that's similar about that is that human safety is the number one priority. You know, it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in. If you're in a small boat and you get knocked off, it's not going to be a good thing. So we come from a perspective of being as safe as we possibly can be and trying to limit the unknowns. And so we really go with folks who are trained well, who have worked in close proximity to whales before and understand their behavior. And for as much as we can, we try and minimize the potential for anything to go wrong. But as you've seen in you know, with some of the other groups on the TV show, it's really not up to you in a lot of ways. And you have to calculate whether or not you're willing to take those risks.
And what's the most nerve-wracking part for you?
Well, that's a good question. You know, when we are with animals and we are doing our research, I almost get that tunnel vision. You get really focused on the task that you're doing, and you block out everything else around you because you need to have that kind of focus to get the job done. To me, the things that are most nervous are when we're preparing or when we're going down, because there's so much logistics support and so much resources that go into setting up these expeditions. And you have a limited time there, and you want to be successful, you know, for yourself, for your students, for your colleagues, and for the animals. And to me, the only time I really get nervous is thinking about, gee, what if we get bad weather for these 2 weeks? Or, you know, what if something goes wrong and we can't do the work? I would feel horrible that everything, all that work went into it and we didn't have the opportunity.
And how much planning goes into this? I mean, is it years of planning and budgeting and writing grants? I mean, what's it like?
Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, one of the things that I've tried to do is to develop a long-term ecological research program there, because the whales that we're studying have lifespans that are similar to ours and generation times kind of similar to us. And so if we're interested in looking at the population's change over time or how climate change is affecting these animals, it requires a long time series of going back and doing things over and over and over again. And securing funding for that is really difficult. Getting the ship time is really difficult. Getting all the instruments and the tags and all the gear is can be challenging as well. And so it's generally, we're thinking at least a couple or a few years out when we write these proposals. And as soon as you've got one funded, you're writing another one to be a continuation or to build on what you've learned. So it's a never-ending process in that respect.
So let's talk about your research. Which whales are you studying in Antarctica, and how can you possibly, you know, begin to answer some of your research questions when, you know, like you said, your time there is limited and your opportunities are so limited?
Yeah, so in the area around the Antarctic Peninsula, which is south of South America, we're studying humpback and minke whales, and we're using multi-sensor suction cup tags, we're using satellite tags, we're doing biopsy samples to collect genetic information. And essentially what we're trying to do is piece together what the population of these two species is like, and then try and understand their behavior. And from that behavior, try and understand the aspects of the environment that these animals need to survive, and then put that in the context of change and understand how the changes that we're seeing occur there will affect one species or another in different ways. And sample size is difficult, but we've got to the point with these animals where we don't go to the Antarctic with a new technology. We've tested it somewhere else, either in the Pacific Northwest or off of Cape Cod or somewhere else like California. So we know we're taking down good equipment, and we work as hard as we can to get as much information as we can in the time that we've got.
And what are you finding? How are whales responding to climate change?
You know, I think it's a really interesting thing that we're seeing. So the most glaring change that we see in the Antarctic Peninsula is the amount of sea ice that forms every year. And over the last 30 years, when it's been monitored, the number of ice cover days has decreased by almost 80 days a year.
Wow.
And that habitat is really critical for an animal like a minke whale that's endemic to the Antarctic. It lives in that sea ice, and it's evolved to take advantage of that environment. And so as that habitat shrinks and goes away, there's much less room for those animals to be there. So those animals are likely moving their distribution away or simply not growing their populations. And conversely, humpback whales, which do much better in open water, are going gangbusters. Ever since commercial whaling stopped and the blue whales and the fin whales and the sei whales were all killed and taken out of that environment, humpback whales are the ones that have rebounded where those others haven't, because they can reproduce quickly. They have a breeding ground that's sort of centrally located where everybody goes to, and they've got some unique feeding strategies. So humpback whales are taking advantage and almost replacing the Antarctic species like minke whales in some of the places that we're working.
That's fascinating. You know, one of the themes that kind of goes through this TV show is that the Antarctic is such a pristine, you know, untouched by human hands sort of environment. And I kind of thought, well, what about whales? You know, it seems like they were just decimated. And now, like you said, we're now seeing that they're just beginning to recover. I mean, do you agree with that? And what's to come?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I tell people when we go down either on tourist ships or I lecture, I say, you know, the fact that there's this many penguins and seals, it may be a reflection of the fact that there's not as many whales around. And in the places that we work on the Antarctic Peninsula, in the 1920s, over 20,000 blue whales and fin whales were killed right in the areas that we work now. And the only whales that we see now in that area are humpback whales and occasionally minke whales. So we took out 2 million whales from the Southern Ocean in the 20th century alone. And the gap that created in the ecosystem allowed other animals to sort of fill in and take advantage of those resources. And so while, yeah, you don't see a lot of junk, you don't see plastic all over the place, the scars of human activity there are really apparent if you know what you're looking for.
So your research is possibly going to inform some policy. I mean, what sort of protections are in place right now for minke whales or humpback whales in that area?
So all of those animals are protected by a number of different things. In the United States, we have the Marine Mammal Protection Act that protects all of those animals from negative consequences. The Antarctic is also managed by an international treaty, the Antarctic Conservation Act, that protects animals as well. And then on top of that, there is a burgeoning krill fishery that's been operating in that area for 20 or 30 years, maybe even a little longer. That's managed by another organization. But in the laws about how much krill you can take and where you can take it, one of the stipulations is that you in no way endanger or minimize the opportunity for krill predators to exist in that environment. So one of the things that we're learning is, if we can simply say where it is that we find these whales and where is it critical for them to forage, we can look and see, is there overlap between where the krill fishery is occurring? And if so, we need to minimize the number of krill that are taken out of there. Or if they're not, we want to almost put up a fence around there and say, you know what, there are places on this Antarctic continent that should be away from any more human activity. And if we can provide good enough evidence to say that this is a critical area for humpback or minke whales, let's just not even go there with fishing vessels and leave that environment as intact as we can.
What are they harvesting krill for?
It's interesting. You know, most of the krill that is caught is not for human consumption. Krill oil, you know, that's rich in omega-3 fatty acids is something that some of that krill gets used for. But I think the majority of it gets used as protein or fish meal to grow other fish in other parts of the world. So it's kind of a double negative in that you're taking out those krill and they're just being used to support another industry somewhere else.
How has scientific whaling helped or hindered your research? And what's your opinion on scientific whaling?
You know, my opinion is that I don't believe that the questions that are being asked as a justification for that scientific whaling are necessary. We've done a lot of work, and a lot of people have dedicated a significant amount of time to developing tags and sensors that can answer basically the same questions that are the justification for why you would have to lethally sample a whale. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done in that respect to come up with non-lethal methods for understanding how many times the whale feeds, the foraging behavior of these animals, and understand exactly what they're doing in a way that allows us to not interfere too much with their survival.
And on the show, you had tagged with a suction cup tag and then biopsy sampled a humpback whale. And what happened with that whale? What sort of information were you able to gain from sampling in both of these ways?
Yeah, it basically lets us put together almost a resume for that whale. The biopsy sample is really critical. We can tell what breeding population that whale comes from. So that whale in that situation was one that breeds off the west coast of Central America in either Panama or Colombia. We can tell if that whale is a male or a female. We can tell if she's pregnant, if she's a female. We can look at the stable isotopes or the fats in her lipid and determine what diet, how much she's feeding on krill versus other things. And then the suction cup tag tells us precisely how many times that whale is feeding, what depth it's feeding on, how much energy it's expending to do this feeding. And then the video on there actually allows us to see the prey that the whale are feeding on and sort of how it navigates its environment. So we can get a really good understanding of sort of a day in the life of an Antarctic humpback whale. And then we can sort of forecast what it means for that animal over the season that it's in the Antarctic and how it's going to sort of benefit from all of this open water.
And how is an Antarctic humpback whale foraging compared to one, say, in Alaska? Are there differences?
There are. And a lot of the differences we think have to do with the prey that you're feeding on. So one of the most kind of striking things that happens in Alaska is this bubble net feeding on herring, where you get these groups of, you know, up to 15 whales making a big bubble net and making this really haunting sort of vocalization. And then everybody comes up in the middle in this very, precise and active foraging. And in the Antarctic, we see animals feeding mostly by themselves, occasionally in groups of two or three. And we've only in the last maybe 10 or 15 years even seen bubble net feeding occurring. So we're kind of witnessing the evolution of new behaviors in these species every time we go down and put a tag on these animals. And so for humpbacks in the Antarctic, krill form these massive, dense schools or aggregations that they don't really have to make a bubble net around to corral like you might have to for herring or sand lance or some other kinds of fish. So the whales have a much easier time feeding than they do in other parts of the world.
I have a question here from our mailbag. And it says, this is from Jill, as a marine ecologist, you see firsthand how climate change is affecting our oceans. I'm guessing you wouldn't do what you do if you didn't believe we could all make a difference. How do you remain hopeful for our oceans?
Well, Jill, it's a really good question. And you're absolutely right that I do believe that through science and through education and through showing people the things that are valuable, we can make a huge difference. We wrote a paper a couple of years ago with some of our colleagues about humpback whales and that how in the Southern Hemisphere, most of those populations have rebounded to the point that they're at the level of that they were before whaling occurred, and that this is a conservation success story, and that we need to champion that. We need to have a party, and we need people to recognize that there are things that we can do, and generally as people, it means doing less or leaving things alone, but there are things that we're doing that are having tangible effects. Humpback whales are doing really well right now, and we should be supportive of that and show people that if you put the resources into it, if you believe in that, and if you care enough about it to change your behavior, it can have positive outcomes. And I think it's very important for people to have hope and optimism with respect to conservation.
And for you, you know, personally, what gets you really excited about some of your future work?
There's a few things. You know, I get excited about the new discoveries. I feel like every time we go out and every time we put a tag out, we're learning something new about these animals. And I get to do this with my friends and my colleagues, and to share the experience with people that I care about is really meaningful. But also then to be able to share that with the public and to share that with students and people who are just generally interested, and have an outlet like National Geographic to share that passion that we have for learning and conserving and understanding our natural world. I really couldn't ask for a better situation to be in, and I hope that we're taking advantage of it in a way that makes it obvious how much we care about this, and hopefully other people do as well.
And is there something that, like, we as people far away from Antarctica can do to help these whales?
Well, you know, there are so many little battles you can fight locally, as well as globally. You know, depending on where you are, there are certainly going to be things that you can do to minimize the impact of humans on whales, you know, from choosing the kind of seafood that you eat, to minimizing the use of plastics, to, you know, changing your behavior to, you know, limit the fossil fuels that you use. All of those things will have an impact if enough people are doing them. And it's very hard to act in a way that you think might have an impact in a place like the Antarctic, but hopefully by exposing the research that we do and humanizing it through National Geographic, people will feel a little stronger connection to a place that may be very distant geographically, but I think emotionally is something that everybody can relate to.
I think I read in an article that the mothership that you're sort of based on is also a tourist ship. Does that mean that people can, like, tag along with you?
Yeah, you know, so the bulk of our research is done from National Science Foundation vessels that are dedicated to science. But more and more, we are taking the opportunity to work with tour companies who are interested in promoting science and engaging their passengers and having scientists on board to make the experience for those passengers better. And so we promote that quite heavily. And I can't think of a better opportunity as a passenger than to go down to a place that's being actively researched and be there sort of embedded with the researchers so that we can go out and we can show you what we did. You know, we put a tag on and we get it back. We can show the video to people and explain what the whales are doing or explain what it is that we're doing with our science. And it enhances the experience for people. It gets them more motivated and passionate about the things that they care about. And I think is a win-win for us as scientists to be able to turn into better educators and communicators, and then for the public to be getting more information that can be more useful in the future. And, you know, on these tour boats, I try and tell people that if you come to the Antarctic, you kind of leave with this sense of responsibility for being able to communicate that to your friends. You know, tell them what you saw, tell them what you learned and what people are doing down there and how, you know, we can have an impact in making sure that this place remains wild and pristine outside of our reaches.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that the food isn't bad either, right?
You know, the food is not bad at all. The tour trips are short enough that you don't ever run out of fresh vegetables and fresh food, whereas the science trips that we go on tend to be a little bit longer. And, you know, at the end, you're really itching for something crunchy.
I'm sure. Well, the season finale is tomorrow, December 20th, and I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed watching this show. So thank you so much for all of the work that you're doing, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
I really appreciate it. And you know, folks have questions about the work we're doing or down there or in any other part, I'd definitely encourage them to keep watching the show and look us up online at the Marine Mammal Institute at Oregon State. And I'm happy to try and answer anybody's questions that they have.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks again for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. And thank you all for sending in your questions today. And just a reminder, there is a Indiegogo fundraiser going on right now for Whale Scout. Help us help the whales in 2017. Go up to whalescout.org, find the link right on the front page, and browse through tons of awesome perks for your donations. And if you love this podcast, go up to iTunes or our website, and you'll find plenty more episodes. Up next, we will have Mark Laren Young. He is the author of The Killer Whale Who Changed the World. So tune in for another great podcast. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. J'entretiens ma gueule négligée.